ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time for your Friday. Corbin Middlemass alongside World Cup winner Xavier Doherty, who's in the chair again today for Ed Cowan. Boy, do we have a lot to chop up with Australia out of the T20 World Cup. All the favourites made it through to the Super 8 stage, except the Aussies, with Zimbabwe booking their place in where we thought the Aussies were going to be. The Sheffield Shield, round 8's come to a close. The Aussie women are back in the winners list. We've got a whole lot to chop up. First of all, X, very good morning to you down in the beautiful Apple Isle.
Hello, Corby. Hello to all our potties tuning in. It has been a massive week in cricket. Do we look a little foolish just when we sat down on, was it Monday or Tuesday, and just assuring everyone out there that Australia would make it through?
Mm.
And it wasn't to be. Sri Lanka did us again, and Australia, once they play this dead rubber against Oman, and fingers crossed they win that.
Yeah.
Because all hell will break loose. There might have to be a crisis potty tomorrow if that doesn't happen. But yeah, we egg on our face a little bit there, just assuring Australia we'll get through, and they haven't.
So three games on the first 13 days of the tournament, and then tonight there's only one game, which is to conclude the group stage. And instead of being this climactic finish to the group stage and thinking, oh, they got to try and get a certain net run rate or whatever it turns out to be, you know, what a limp finish, Australia and Oman, to see who finishes down the bottom of the group. And by the way, Zimbabwe won last night, so they actually topped the group. They beat Sri Lanka. So as much as it was, oh, you know, they got the washout and they advanced and everything else, and they caused the one upset against Australia, and they're the team to beat coming out of the group.
Well, was it an upset? Does that make Australia look any better or worse now that they dropped that game? And to be fair, it wasn't even close. Was it 30-odd runs in the end that Zimbabwe beat Australia by? So they're on a bit of a roll, and knocking off the hosts there is another good scout for Zimbabwe. But looking at tonight's game, there'll be a lot of eyeballs on tonight's game, Corb. Like, I know this is a dead rubber for Australia, but there'll be a lot of people around the country, and I'm speaking to those English, who will be watching and praying that Australia drop this game. So there'll be some eyeballs on it, no doubt about that.
Not much to gain and a whole lot to lose from an Australian
correct.
Point of view with their
that
campaign's over. So India and Pakistan out of Group A, Sri Lanka, Zimbabwe out of Group B, West Indies, England out of Group C, and South Africa, New Zealand out of Group D. So there are pre-seedings. So basically Zimbabwe just take the seeding of the Australians. So that's basically what will happen there, and they'll find themselves on that side of the draw come the Super 8s, which will begin the following night. So the last of the pool games to be played tonight. Well, we got a whole lot to chop up from an Australian point of view. By the way, shout out to our man Brian Bennett, who I told you a little bit of the backstory of him, the back of his baseball card. Got a little unbeaten half century last night in Zim's win. What happened in that Sri Lanka game firstly? So just specific on the match, I mean, they made 180-odd batting first. It didn't end well. I think they lost something like 6 for 21 to complete the innings, so didn't quite cash in on the back end. But I don't know, X, I still felt at the halfway mark that 181, you know, of Australian teams of the past, even at a place like Kandy and everything else, that was defendable from that position. And yet, in the end, they couldn't get Pathan Nasankar out, and that was all she wrote.
Yeah, well, I think everyone's been talking about and leading into that match and since has been focusing on the batting and whether Steve Smith should have played or whether Cameron Green should be there or Maxwell's form. A lot of the talking points have been around the batting. I think we've undersold the fact that our bowling lineup is not what it used to be and not what we expected it to be 6 weeks ago coming into this World Cup. You know, we lost Stark. We knew that a while ago. They tried to find someone to replace him. Xavier Bartlett was the man to earmark that. Nathan Ellis to lead the attack, who's a very good white ball bowler. But losing Cummins and losing Hazelwood has impacted this team more than we thought it was going to be. And you look at the fact that Stoinis opened the bowling. Sean Abbott wasn't able to get a game there. The fact that Zampa, who is world-class, by the way, and his record speaks for itself, the fact that they're not getting wickets up front impacts his bowling as well. The game against Zimbabwe, again, 170 in those conditions is too many. So I think we're underselling the fact that, yes, the batting didn't stand up, and we were well on track for 200-plus the other night against Sri Lanka and didn't get there and wobbled towards the end. But Sri Lanka walked it in. That, you know, it's the bowling that was sort of was our loose chain there, our loose link, and same against Zimbabwe as well. 170 was too many, and it's something that no doubt the selectors, who are copping a bit of grief, and I'm sure we'll get to that, it's something that they'll have to look at over the next little while and look for some X factor players. And there were a few during the Shield this week that stood up. Maybe they're the ones that we should have been looking at.
So did we not pick the right guys, or is the cupboard bare?
No, well, this is it. I there are people coming for the selectors, and as I said, I'm sure we'll talk about it left, right, and centre. But there were no arguments about it leading into the everyone's an expert in hindsight. There were no arguments about the selections leading into it. Abbott and Dorchus and Xavier Bartlett, you know, they're all very good 2020 bowlers, aren't they? And they were all the stars, I guess, in our domestic BBL. So there were no arguments there. But just having a look at it on paper and the way it unfolded in those conditions, it clearly wasn't enough. You know, we didn't get the wickets at the top to make an impact. And, you know, we haven't made it out of the group stage. So, you know, they certainly weren't going to go far if they had got through it and when we did take it up against those top teams.
I found the post-mortem fascinating from the cricket fraternity. And it's been everything from, you know, we don't respect T20 cricket. Australia never has. We've always looked at it as a bit gimmicky and a bit of a joke. So that's sort of been one side of the argument. And then everything from, you know, it's diabolical and shambolic and everything else. And it makes me think, yeah, how can it be both? Like, how can it be an absolute, you know, disaster in a sporting context that Australia, you know, haven't achieved more? And also we don't treat it, you know, serious enough. I mean, that there's no doubt in the 2 years in between the World Cups, this team was primed to make a run at it here. I mean, they went 17-4, so they've got a great team. They've got the best that basically the IPL has to offer. That's essentially what this team is. And yet now it's sort of like we've reached this sort of huge flashpoint in time as to how the nation addresses T20 cricket and you know, the stinging fallout and the critique of the team and how it's gone. I mean, clearly they copped injuries at the wrong time, that they were out of form. And the other thing is, and Crash Craddock sort of outlined this, where he basically spoke about the team that was picked, about, you know, they picked a batting bully team to be successful in India, almost overlooking the part that, hey, we'll get through the group in Sri Lanka and we'll make it work on the wickets that obviously turn a lot more. And maybe they missed a trick there, as you say, in hindsight. And that's where someone like Steve Smith, for example, probably would have been useful for them. I guess my biggest criticism comes from the fact that they didn't even name 15 players. Like, they had 14 players for the first two games. And so they were probably thinking, look, we don't need a reserve opener, so there's no place for Steve Smith. In the end, they did need the reserve opener because of what happened to Mitch Marsh. And again, that's, you know, easy to say in hindsight. But they added him to the squad anyway. Before the third game, he wasn't picked. And you think, you've gone through the tournament with 14 players. If you may as well have had him. Like, it's sort of mind-numbing to think how they got to that point with basically a spare spot on the roster.
Right. Where do I start here, Corb? That's a lot.
There's a lot in that.
That's a lot to process. Firstly, there's an old adage in sport, and I'm sure all our potties have heard it. It's you're never going as well as you think you are, and it's never as bad as you think it is. So the fallout has been pretty brutal, but I don't think Australian cricket is in this dark, dreary place that can never get out of it. Yes, we've had a very disappointing result over there in Sri Lanka, and they haven't made it out of their group stage. The cupboard's not bare. You know, there are some very, you look, as you mentioned, we do have the best, the world's best in our team and in our country. And there's some quite a few good players who, as you mentioned, are injured and didn't quite get there or out of form or still making their way through the ranks. So the cupboard's not bare. So we're not going as bad as we think we are. Yes, very, very disappointing. Very disappointing results. The point on only picking 14, no doubt they were just banking on getting through and just playing it cool, as we touched on the other day, Corb. They don't jump at shadows, these selectors. They stick the course. They stay the course. They were giving themselves, and, you know, in hindsight, they could have looked like geniuses if they'd got through this stage. And it's like, right, who is going to be the 15th player? Do we go Abbott? Do we go Smith? Do we pluck someone out of... Do we need another leg spinner? Do we need another, whoever it might be? They could have looked like geniuses, but as you said, in hindsight, we are all experts, and it didn't look great. The fact that they brought Steve Smith in, didn't end up using him. Yes, they could have brought him in, but who do they bring him in for? You know, he's made his runs at the top of the order. We're not dropping Mitch Marsh. We're not dropping Travis Head. So then they're now playing a guy, Steve Smith, out of position, which they've got criticism for as well. So, you know, was that the right way to go? So we can't sort of have it both ways as critics. So
I think I said on Monday that that's the team I thought they would go with, yeah, and then on Monday night they named that team. I mean, that's been the way they've gone. So I can understand why Steve Smith didn't play, and yet that seems to be the big talking point and where a lot of the criticism has come. Yeah, Mark Waugh, who's a former selector himself, by the way, came out and said the non-selection of Steve Smith in the squad originally is the most baffling non-selection I can remember for ages. I just think that they got the selections completely wrong, and they had their best player by 100 yards sitting on the sideline in Steve Smith. I think it's an insult to Smith, to be honest, which was a strong take to basically say that, yeah, it's an insult to him not to be picked.
Well, it's unlike Mark Waugh to come out and stick up for a fellow blue bagger, isn't it? But I could get really nasty here, Cor, because as you mentioned, Mark Waugh has been a selector himself. And I won't go down that path because as a selector, he should know better. Like, we are all experts in hindsight. I went through the 2014 World Cup squad and you look at some of the names that played in that and you're just thinking, man, what were the selectors thinking? What were they? There are some names there. And as I said, I won't go down that path. But if you sort of scroll through the list of selections over the years, you can pinpoint selectors for anything. So I get the criticism. You know, I get it. It's a bad result. And everyone's entitled to have their say, which is a great thing as well. You know, we're all, you know, everyone's outraged these days and feel like they need to have their say. And there are platforms for people and fans and experts to have that. So I get it. But from Mark Waugh, to say we were doomed from the start and it's an insult. And, you know, they were pretty stinging words for someone who sat in that chair before. I think and I feel, and I know it's his role, he's in the media. He, you know, he's got a role to say what he thinks. But as I mentioned, someone who's been in that chair before should know what it feels like to when things don't work out. It's not necessarily all the selectors' fault. And I feel like the 11 guys out there are getting away with it a little bit here.
Yeah, I agree. And I've been, I mean, both out of night at different times, I've asked questions of the selectors and, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm in the good books with the selectors or anything like that. I mean, I haven't spoken to any of them in the last 14 months since Nathan McSweeney was picked and the fallout, obviously, that went along with that. But I can understand why they went with the team they went with and the how it all panned out. I actually think had we drawn... You know, say we played our pool games in India, for example. Maybe this sounds like the most arrogant Australian cricket thing ever, but yeah, I feel like if we played our group games in India, it would even be a different story. Like part of the conditions and everything baked into it, but they were in winning positions in those games, and ultimately they didn't get it done, and that's the nature of cricket. Crash Craddock wrote about whether it's a glimpse into the future or not. He went on to basically say, look, it was one of Australia's most shambolic campaigns of the century, and it left a provocative question hanging in the air. Was this a snapshot of the future? He spoke about the fact there was no Cummins, Stark, Hazelwood, also Lyon, Smith and Carey all absent, and it won't be too long into the future where all six of them disappear out of the international game completely. He went on to talk about the previous history. If you go all the way back to the 80s when Lilly, Rodmarsh and Greg Chappell all departed the scene together, Australia didn't win another test match for 4 years. Where's the, if you've got a scale of 1 to 10x, where should my level of concern be about, I guess what this represents going forward, given, all these guys sort of got hurt at the same time and were absent and what it means for our national team going forward?
No, well, I've touched on it before. The cupboard's not bare. We've got, anyone who watched the BBL would suggest that cricket is in a pretty good place in Australia. This was a disappointing result, and the criticism's fair as well. So we should be criticised for dropping out in the group stages and losing to Zimbabwe. Which can happen in 2020 cricket. I get, but then losing to Sri Lanka again. That sort of starts to piece together that this hasn't gone right. But the cupboard's not bare. And again, I feel it was the bowling. And we did lose two of the best bowlers in world cricket on the eve of the tournament. And so I think we're underselling that. I sat down during the week and watched Riley Meredith bowl. And I'm going to get accused of being a Tasmanian bias there. But the guy was bowling mid-140s and troubling New South Wales batters on a really flat wicket. So and selectors aren't going to come out and say who they, what they would do in hindsight because, they're just not going to. But I would suggest if they had their chance again, yes, Dorshus has shown to be a good T20 bowler and Abbott and Bartlett, but do they need that X factor, just raw pace? Jai Richardson in the last couple of weeks has got himself fit and firing. If they had their time again, would that have gone down Would they have gone down that path? So, yes, the criticism is fair, and so people should come out and have their say, because this hasn't gone the way that we expected it to. But the cupboard's not bare. There are some very good T20 cricketers out there. As you mentioned, Corb, another T20 rolls around again. T20 World Cup rolls around again in a couple of years' time, which is another point. We do get accused of just fobbing it off, but the ICC are the ones who put them every 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, we can be accused of downplaying it, but when you have them every second year, plus a 50-over World Cup, which is, in my eyes, still the main one, every 4 years, so we should fob them off. You know, it does diminish the value of a major trophy.
It's the same reason the Olympics is every 4 years, for example. Like, if that was every 2 years, it wouldn't.
Mate, yep. There's got to be some prestige about it. And yep. I think the money grab from the ICC to keep just shoving these down our throats, it does diminish it. So, yeah, you can accuse the fans and the experts of downplaying it, or those within the dressing room of downplaying it, but that's the environment we live in.
We're co-hosts for the next one, by the way. So 2028, okay, with New Zealand. So there'll be a lot of focus on that, obviously, given it's coming back on home soil.
So 2028, there's an Olympic T20 tournament and a World Cup.
Yes. But one of them we haven't yet qualified for. So we're the hosts. Right. So we'll be there for obviously the T20 World Cup. But Daniel Cherney wrote about this, basically saying, hey, people are craving meaning in bilateral T20s. Well, you've got it now. So essentially, Australia are second in the Oceania rankings behind New Zealand if the Kiwis go through to the Final Four. So they're in the Super 8 stage at the moment. If they qualify for the semifinals, which, you know, is a 50-50 chance from here, then essentially Australia's ranking will fall. And as a result, New Zealand will be in the box seat to go through as the Oceania qualifier, or the regional qualifier for the six-team tournament in the LA Games. There's only five spots up for grabs. One of them is held by the United States as the host nation. And so then the other five teams, basically, there are some automatic qualifiers. And then other than that, you would have to go through a qualifying period. So essentially, Australia needs to get their ranking up to avoid playing in this, you know, repechage tournament and just to qualify for the LA Games. So our pesky little cousin across the ditch is all of a sudden getting in our way for direct qualification, X.
And do we know the cutoff point? So that obviously would mean that New Zealand are our favourites right now, but 2028 is a long way away. Is it like the end of 2027, or is it something like that? We don't know that just at the moment.
I haven't got that in front of me.
When do the rankings? No, okay.
I'm sure that's part of the piece, but it does at least take care of the next, I think, the next 12 months at least, next period of time.
Yeah. Okay, right. So they've got some work to do. You wouldn't want to be falling into a racing 10 again for one spot, or wouldn't have thought.
A couple of other pieces of the fallout. So I feel like we're doing this from every angle. There's so much to get to. Both Andrew McDonald and Tony Dottomate have spoken. Tony Dottomate to Dan Cherney in the News Corp papers went on to say he insisted that Josh Hazlewood and Pat Cummins would have missed the IPL and played in the World T20 had the tournaments been the other way around. So trying to, you know, hose down some of the cynicism, I guess, around the fact that, hey, these guys are staying fit for the IPL but not playing for the country in the tournament, which is on our doorstep. Are you buying that?
That's an unfair swipe. Anyone who's having a go at Cummins and Hazlewood for their integrity at representing Australia or representing their IPL clubs and cash grabbing, I think. I think that's really unfair. No doubt if these guys were fit, they would have played. And, you know, to say that they're saving themselves for a cash grab is quite disrespectful, I think. So, I think that's fair enough from Tony Dottomate to come out and defend those guys.
He also defended Cam Green as well. And Crash Craddock wrote about this, basically saying, hey, young players, it's one thing to give them opportunities, but are we spoiling them rotten? I think was the quote. Tony Dottomate defended Cam Green's importance as a three-format player. He went on to say he was our best batsman in the series against Pakistan. He's still developing his game across all formats. He's now 26 years of age, Cam Green. I know a lot of our listeners get a little frustrated that they feel like sometimes we in the media, perhaps, and those around the team sort of talk about him as if he's in his early 20s as opposed to, you know, now on the other side of 25. But where do you sit on that?
He hasn't had the summer that he wanted. And I guess the criticism from me would be if that's the case, you know, he didn't have a great Ashes and he was under the pump a little bit there to hold his spot. Why didn't he play some Big Bash towards the end there? Like, I know you need the mental break, but if they're going to come out and say they're prioritising the T20 World Cup, why wouldn't your number three, after not scoring runs, why would he go and have a couple of weeks off and not represent the Perth Scorchers? So, In a format where you can sort of be free and you can sort of let loose a little bit. They play on a very good wicket over there in Perth. That might have been an opportunity for them or for him to come out and just free the arms a little bit and get himself up to speed in T20 cricket. So I like him in our team, and I know that every player goes through form slumps, and that's fine. But if you're going to go through form slumps, you've sort of got to be seen to be doing everything about it. And for him to come off the ashes and have effectively 3 or 4 weeks off, I get the mental refresh and all that sort of stuff. But if you're going to say you're prioritising the T20 World Cup, then all your players have got to be, you know, fit and firing in that BBL space when they've got that opportunity.
I love that Andrew McDonald has spoken too, firstly. So I saw this, again, reported by Dan Cherney on Code Sports. I'm not sure if it was an open forum. I know they don't do that a whole lot nowadays. It's often, you know, a closed circuit when the senior coach speaks. He said in response to Australia's exit, obviously, from the tournament, I think debate around selection is always great. There's always differing opinions. Sometimes the people on the outside don't understand what the moving parts are and the conversations are on the inside. And it's fair for them to critique us at this particular point in time. He went on to say, I think it's unfair to say that a lot of these players wouldn't be in the next phase. So suggestions that, hey, it's time to hit the reset button and turn it over. I think that's the easy option to say, well, that didn't work here. These players are incredibly talented. They're very good T20 players and some of the best that we've seen. We've been fully locked into this for a period of time. This was one of our priorities. He went on to say after that, to sit back and say that we're prioritising other formats or other versions of the game and not the T20 World Cup is entirely false.
Well, I've just touched on the Cameron Green situation. I have no doubt they prioritised it. And you look at the Hobart Hurricanes, for example, Tim David, who from all reports wasn't a bad hamstring. He was ruled out immediately. Like they knew how important he was going to be for their T20 World Cup. And Nathan Ellis as well, like another guy who had a little niggle and they took no risks whatsoever, knowing the importance of his role within that team. So, but then on the flip side, as I mentioned, Green didn't play. So I've no doubt that there is a lot going on. And, you know, I'm a mate with Bales and, you know, I understand, you know, he doesn't talk a lot about it, but I understand, you know, just with some of the hints he gives away, there's a lot more going on than probably the general public understands and that they can explain, because the more they explain, the more they're going to get found out, I think. So there's only so much they can tell us.
So, but so that's what I find interesting. Why don't they just tell us?
I think you leave yourself in a corner. If you start just being so open and honest, I get it. And in an ideal world, that's the way. But like realistically, they can't. Like you just can't just divulge every information and just be an open book and tell us where everyone sits and who's in form and who's next in line and who's on the chopping block and all this sort of stuff, because you just leave yourself open for more criticism. We say it all the time, like, you know, why don't they? But there's a very good reason why they don't, because you can't possibly win because you're already getting criticised from every angle.
But we get
the more information is worse.
We get stuff wrong all the time, but at least if you sort of, it's a competition of ideas. You lay out your ideas and you say, hey, this is how I came to this conclusion. And it's not always correct. But at least at the end of the day, you can go, I understand how they got there. So again, I'm left to draw conclusions from the outside. So I say, look, Steve Smith wasn't in the squad because he's not going to play unless he plays as an opener. So he's not going to play in front of Marsh or Travis Head. And I think most people sort of go, oh, I can understand that. If I've got three guys to pick from, I can only pick two of them. I can understand how in a schoolyard game or whatever it turns out to be, you would pick Marsh and Head over Steve Smith. But I don't understand why you just wouldn't say that. Like, it's just...
You're a rational person, though, Corb.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've jumped on social media this week.
Correct.
There aren't many rational people out there, though. Like, the outrage is real. So, and I just think the more information people have is not always better. Like, I don't think it's always better. I think you cannot please everyone. And particularly when you're the head, you know, you're a selection panel, you know, forever and a day, it's been the most criticised job in Australia.
But I think the sensible majority would be, like, you would be a little more understanding. So here's a great... This is probably the broader conversation I was hoping to get to when it comes to the selectors, right? So why the temperature is so hot now, right? So there's a number of reasons baked into this. One is, you know, people will go, I don't actually subscribe to this theory. You'll go all the way back to the fallout of Justin Langer and the past players that felt slighted by that. And so as a result, feels like they're on other sides of the street immediately, right? And so a lot of the stinging critiques that come from the past players as to the way that was handled and the accusations of the inmates running the asylum and blah, 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 and everything that goes along with it. Let's say that's one reason why it may be the case. The other one is, and this is probably where I more fall into the bucket, is the way that they present themselves. So we don't hear from them often, so it actually makes them less relatable. They're these mystery people that kind of exist in the background. They run this team, at least the way I view it, almost like a franchise side, that it's, you know, us in the bubble, and it's not the Australian cricket team where once upon a time, you know, it felt like it was a public good and everybody had a stake in it, for example. And so as a result, because it was our team as the cricketing public, you would hear why and how the team's, you know, put together, and you would constantly have that dialogue that plays out with the general public. It feels like because so much of that happens behind closed doors, there's this disconnect between us, the fans of the team ultimately, and what happens inside the selection group and the locker room. And so they should have so many credits in the bank. They've done such a good job for a long period of time. They've just won an Ashes series where, you know, they had to put it together with spit and bubble gum, and they've done a great job to be able to win the Ashes in comprehensive fashion. And yet they are bankrupt when it comes to credits with the general public, that the next minute something goes wrong, everybody's hot on them. And you think, how has it been managed that way? That, and I'm like, is that a media? Is that the perception? Is it the way that they've put themselves out there? What advice are they getting from their media team to say, hey, this is how you need to represent yourself, so when things go bad, you know, basically you have a little bit of goodwill there? It feels like they should have a lot more than what they've got. And I can't understand why they don't.
What? Again, it's a lot to unpack there, Corb. They do have a lot of credits in the bank. But again, I think they all understand the position they're in, that you can't win. If you're a selector, and I'm going to be accused of sticking up for my mates here, but they know you can't win. You can't come out at the end of an Ashes series where, like you say, they have put it together with duct tape and beaten a very good cricket team. England are a very good cricket team. They didn't play their best cricket, but partly due to some of the pressure and the strength of Australian cricket and some moving parts within that team, which Andrew McDonald alluded to. You know, they plucked guys out and made some unpopular decisions, which worked, but they know that they can't win. No matter what, they can be as good as... Australian cricket is in a very good position. They've had a bad couple of weeks, yes, but they're in a very good... The selectors have done a very good job to this point. They've made unpopular decisions, but unpopular decisions which most of the time have worked. It hasn't worked this time. I can't agree with you to saying laying it out on the table. Like you say, the Justin Langer thing, there are obviously some relationship issues in there. If they come out and say that, you can't come out and say, look, a couple of our senior players don't get along with the coach, this is why we're getting rid of him. Mm. Which from all reports, I don't know that. From all reports, that's what's happened. If they come out and start speaking like that, no, I think all hell will break loose.
More what I meant about that was, I feel like, you know, maybe some of the criticism from the past players that are in the media has an extra 5-10% on it because of the way that was handled. And so then as a result, they sort of went insular, which, I mean, even Ed said a few weeks ago, he's never seen sort of a bubble around a team perhaps as much as around this one. And I understand what you're saying. They feel like, hey, look, even when we win, you criticize us anyway. So what does it matter? Why would we come out and explain whatever it turns out to be? I guess what I worry for, from their point of view, and maybe if I was advising them and everything else, I would probably suggest doing it differently, that, you know, there's this old saying that, you know, it's easier to catch flies with honey than vinegar. So you sort of think, well, maybe if you're a little nicer the people that are criticizing you, then perhaps, you know, some of the criticism won't be as strong when it comes back. The other thing is, by the way, it's like this and the team's largely winning. You know, look at the 18 months that's coming up. I think, like, imagine how hot it's going to be if things don't go well when they head to South Africa or when they head to India, for example, and that knocks into an overseas Ashes series. Like, these are banner series and they're all very different. Like, what they're going to need to be successful in South Africa is not what they're going to need to be successful in India, is not what they're going to need to be successful in England. So It's a fascinating 18 months ahead, and it feels like already the house is on fire and they've just pulled off all these great feats. I don't know.
I'll get back to my point. Is that it's been a rough couple of weeks, but my feeling is Australian cricket isn't as bad as, you know, the last 2 weeks have suggested. Yeah. So I've got the feeling it'll turn around and it'll be amazing what throwing Cummins and Hazelwood back into that team will do. And Steve Smith, no doubt, when the tests roll it around again. So they'll still be a very good cricket team for a little while longer yet. But, yeah, you're right, there are some challenges ahead.
I,
t-
And for a three-man panel that's ultimately done a great job for Australian cricket over a long period of time now, I think they need some PR work. Like they need more love from the general public than what they're getting, and this is how hot it is at this particular stage, and that's the thing that sort of concerns me a bit going forward. All right, I think we've done that from just about every single angle when it comes to the Australian cricket team, but we're into the Super 8s stage of the tournament, and it's obviously going on without us. So India and Pakistan out of Group A, Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe, West Indies in England and South Africa and New Zealand. Who wins it from here, X?
That's a great question. South Africa have looked pretty hot. Mm-hmm. They stumbled and staggered their way through Afghanistan, who are a better cricket team than a lot of people think. But India, you would suggest, as hosts, have cruised so far. It's T20 cricket. Any team on their day can perform, and it's great to see that some of the minnows or lesser-like nations have pushed some of the bigger teams. India are still my favourites. Home-ish conditions, they might end up playing a bit more in Sri Lanka than they anticipated. But, India is still me. What about you, Corb?
It's hard to go past the host. Abhishek Sharma, by the way, what's going on with him? The best T20 batsman in the world. He's got three straight ducks to start the tournament. He's now got five ducks in his last seven hits in T20 cricket. So for the best batsman of the world, sure. I don't know if that means he's out of form and he's about to come back into form or I don't know if that
well,
bodes
right.
well.
Jeez. It's amazing what winning does. Australia haven't had that luxury, so it'd be interesting to see if they're copying the same grief over there that has come for Cameron Green and Glenn Maxwell over this side of the world.
Yeah. Sheffield Shield cricket on the weekend. I was tuned in last night on the stream. I was listening to you and Pete late at, almost 11 till 10, I think it was at night, 9:49 on the clock when finally they... They shook hands and they said, look, that'll do us, and ended in what was a draw. And as you quite rightfully outlined as part of that coverage on cricket.com.au, for the last hour and a half, it looked like your boys, Tasmania, were the only team that could win the game. So you got a bit more than you bargained for on the last day.
It was amazing. It was a pretty slow-going game for the first few days. Corb, Tassie got bowled out for 130-odd. New South Wales got a mile ahead, 220 ahead on first innings. We had a bit of rain that sort of probably cost, well, it might have cost Tasmania in the end, but ultimately maybe it cost New South Wales just to allowed to have that amount of 50-odd overs, I think we lost on day two, which would have made that chase on day four for New South Wales a hell of a lot easier. But amazing, we mentioned it already, Bo Webster back in form. He is the heart and the heartbeat of Tasmanian cricket just at the moment. And I would assume he's nailed a spot down in that middle order of the test team. And he's come out and proven his worth in that one opportunity he got in Sydney. He was very good during the week in Tasmania. Tasmania ended up with a lead of 200 and, off the top of my head, I can't remember. It was only yesterday. 220?
235. Yep.
235.
Does number eight count as the middle order, by the way, in the test team? Or
is that where...
That's where he batted in Sydney.
Well, that's more credit to Alex Carey for batting up the order.
Correct.
And not dropping behind the all-rounders. But, Tasmania, very good. Yeah, and said New South Wales... 40-odd overs to get that. And with a couple of early wickets, and I've mentioned Riley Meredith, he bowled seriously fast last night, seriously fast. So nice to see him string a few games together and get his pace up. We didn't have the clock on him, but it would have been in the mid-140s, bowled with some real pace, with a pink ball, which doesn't do a lot.
Yeah.
And on a very flat wicket, he was able to make an impact and picked up a few handy wickets yesterday. So
there's something special.
It ended up a draw, but there was a lot to pick out of it.
There's something special about that, isn't there? Like I saw the highlights of his efforts last night, and he was knocking guys over just pure pace. Where like the bat's coming down after the ball's cracked into the stumps, and you
correct. I think Lachie Shaw left a ball that cannoned into middle and off stump, just because it came back a little bit. But it was just the raw pace, and it was too quick for him. So there was an interesting point in the game where Jack Edwards was subbed out. Corb, I'm not sure if this was on the run sheet, but with the sub rule in Shield cricket, he left the game, and Charlie Anderson made his debut for New South Wales. I think player 777 for New South Wales. He came in on day three, which is this new sub rule where the teams can get rid of an injured player halfway through the match and bring in a fresh player. We spoke about it a lot on our coverage during the week. I'm not so sure after 150, 160 years of state cricket, we need to bring in such a rule. Another part of the rule is by doing that, Tasmania get a free shot they can make a free sub and a tactical sub, and they did that. They took Gabe Bell out, who's a frontline fast bowler, and bought Aidan O'Connor in, who's an all-rounder. So that ultimately helped Tasmania as well, strengthen their batting for the second innings when they were in a bit of strife. So it was a really interesting thing that Cricket Australia have run with and brought in this summer. It sounds like the ICC are trying to adopt it. I'm not so sure it's such a good thing for the long form of the game. It's always been about endurance and stamina and pushing through and all that sort of stuff. And I know in this day and age, we've got to have player welfare and safe workplace and all that sort of stuff. But I'm not so sure that for those who love the long form of the game, that is such a great rule.
It feels like they've done everything they can, and you would know this better than anyone as a match referee, to put little tweaks and bits and pieces and sort of small fine print in the rules to basically stop people from doing this. I actually feel like this is the one game of the season where you could actually exploit the rule, and ultimately it feels like we kind of got that a little bit, particularly on a Tasmanian sense. Like the fact that it's got that clause in there where you can't play again for another 11 days. So you would think, well, the only time you would do that is if you had a fast bowler, for example, that wouldn't play in 11 days anyway, because you can't back him up or whatever at the back end of the season. And we're about to enter this period where next week is the one-day cup. So basically they're going to play the last round of those games, and then we got the final. So there ain't any cricket for 7 days anyway. Cricket. And then you think, well, if you come out midway through the game, that saves you another 2 days. So now we're up to 9 days. Then you only have to wait another two, and all of a sudden you're back playing in the next round of Shield cricket. Whereas once we get into rounds 9 and 10, they'll back into each other one after the next. Early in the season, it's the same way. Unless it's kind of before the Big Bash or in this kind of scenario, if you are going to make that move, you're basically sacrificing a player and knowing we're not just going to miss him for the remainder of this fixture, we're also going to miss him for the next one.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. And Cricket Australia have put some thought into it, and they've got that, I think it's a 12-day stand down. Mm. New South Wales' next game is 15 days away. So there's no repercussions there. I'm not saying that it was a genuine hamstring and all that sort of stuff. I'm not calling anyone out by any means. It's just not. And then the other point is New South Wales had two very good spinners in Sanger and Davies, who, guys of national interest, spin-wise, who weren't bowling in the match. Why would you... Isn't that the point of relying on some of those resources to have... Let's call upon the spinner late in the game instead of bringing a fresh fast bowler in. You know, Edwards can sort of make his way through and we'll have a sub fielder and he can bat, you know, hobbled if he needs to. And we'll bowl our spinners a bit more. You know, Australia are short of spin bowling at the minute. We didn't play a frontline spinner in the Sydney Test. We've got these two young New South Welshmen who are craving opportunities, yet we're going to say, no, we're going to pull that fast bowler Edwards out of the match and bring in a fresh fast bowler and top up our fast bowling ranks and leave our spinners short on game time again. So there's a few little points, and it's a trial period. I'll give it that. You know, it sounds like the ICC are pushing it and the BCCI are doing something similar in their first class cricket. So all countries are looking at it, but I'm just not so sure that it's something that the long form of the game needs.
Did it have a material impact on the game?
Well, it did a little. It did a little. Aidan O'Connor came in for Gabe Bell, who doesn't have to have the stand down period. It's a free sub because it was in reply. It's a free sub for Tasmania. If they're in reply to New South Wales, pulled the trigger first, Tassie get a free sub. So Gabe Bell can play tomorrow.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, so they get a free right of reply just to make it fair, and I think that's the fairness issue that they're trying to figure out. Gabe Bell is a genuine number 11. I don't think he would mind me saying that. And Aidan O'Connor is a young guy, 19, 20, who's a middle order player. In time, he will be a top six player for Tasmania. So it wasn't a like for like. It got ticked off as a like for like because Aidan O'Connor does bowl as well. It did strengthen Tasmania's batting. It did sort of reshape the nature of the game. And well done to Charlie Anson. He came in and took his first, it was great to see a debutant, mate. You know, anytime someone comes in and fulfills a dream, it was great to see. So, well done to that young man. He bowled quite well. But, I just didn't like it and didn't like the feel of it that the same 11 that started the match didn't finish it. In my eyes, that's not the way that cricket should be played.
Queensland, devastating batting collapse on the morning of day three, where they were 3 for 111 all out 119. They lost their last 6 wickets for 8 runs as Nathan McAndrew ran through them, 5 for 32. South Australia win inside 3 days and Alex Carey hitting the winning runs there. So that's interesting in terms of the table because those two teams are, a second and third on the table the way that it looks at the moment. So that's significant for the table. South Australia is still third, but the gap's sort of marginal between the two teams now.
Couple of shout-outs here. Nathan McAndrew, who I'm sure that the selectors would have spoken about in the lead-up to the first Ashes test. I'm sure his name would have been bandied around. They ended up going with Doggett and Abbott. Another 5 wickets to him, you know, leading South Australia to, a tough victory there. And Liam Scott, who's another youngster on the rise. You know, he's had a very good summer so far. Someone who bats very – he's very capable with the bat. He's won them games with the bat in all formats this year. And I think he took 5 wickets in the first innings as well there, Corb.
So you think Nathan McAndrew is in those conversations?
I think he's in those conversations. He is in and around and he must have been mentioned. He must have been mentioned. He had a very good summer last year. I know he had a bit of a niggle leading into this summer, but I think the fast bowling rotation can change so quickly. And if you're taking wickets, no matter your age, no matter where you've come from or what your story is, I think he is well and truly in those conversations. I'm not saying, I'm not earmarking him for a baggy green, but he has to be. He has to be. And it's shown that he's knocked over a very capable batting lineup up there in Queensland. And, guys who are match winners, they'd be looking at those, no doubt.
Scott Boland, 6 for 22, match figures of 9 for 71 as Victoria punched their ticket to the Shield final. They also earned the hosting rights in the process. They won by 354 runs against WA at the WACA ground. It was a big match where there was huge individual performances, not just Scott Boland there, but Sammy Harper with
Sammy
the bat.
Harper. Oh.
How good is this as a story?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's 29 years of age. He's playing the best cricket of his career. He's opening the batting and wicket-keeping, which you so rarely see in red ball cricket. He got twin hundreds, and basically he was made a runner ball 100 in the first innings and then was out, and there was another 71 overs. And they were the only 71 overs of the match that he wasn't a live participant, either keeping or batting at any particular stage, because he batted through the second innings completely and ended up with an unbeaten 100. So what a story.
Back-to-back. And did he score a Shield 100 last week as well? I'm pretty sure he scored some runs in the last round of Shield games as well. I don't have that in front of me, Cole, but he's been amongst the runs. I know our listeners will know him from the shortest form of the game, you know, playing for the Renegades and the Stars at different times of his career, you know, an impact player. And yeah, he's clearly having an impact in that Shield team who, as you say, Corb, have locked in a home final, which will be at the Junction Oval, I would imagine, with the MCG out of action. So they have been the dominant team all year. Shout out to Sam Fanning, who fell just short of his 199, I think the youngster got. And outside that, there wasn't a lot of resistance from your WA mob.
No. Will Sutherland, too, made 100. He was 66 not out when Scott Boland joined him at the crease as the number 11 and then still was able to get to 3 figures. And great to see Ollie Peake's okay, too. So he was involved in a scary incident late on day 3 where he was ducking a short ball from Brody Couch. It was right on the tee break. In the end, they took tee as he was being assessed. He didn't return to bat after it. Went off, had concussion tests both later that day and the next day. Symptom free, all good on Thursday. So that's great news for young Ollie Peake. Never like to see that when you don't.
And I had a bit of a go at the concussion at the subs before. That is one place where we do like to see it in this day and age. We know the head impact injuries in all sports is a major issue. So let's keep that. Injury sub, maybe I'm not so sure, but great to see that he's okay.
So 2 rounds to come in the Sheffield Shield. We'll have like a million podcasts before that gets back underway. But March 5 is the next round. Tasmania up against Victoria. Queensland played WA and SA against New South Wales. Interesting to note that the last 2 games for Tasmania are at home. So they're coming from about 5 points back, but there's a bit of an advantage there for Tasmania if they can get a couple of outrights at home. Victoria on top and then a tight gap between Queensland and South Australia in second. Taz still in contention in fourth. New South Wales, you'd have to do some clever maths to make it work, and WA have been eliminated from the title race.
All those teams do play against each other in one of those rounds. So there'll be a bit of mixing and matching over the next couple of weeks to see who makes that final. So I think all but WA are a live chance.
One Day Cup, Speaking of your boys down there in the Apple Isle, so you've already clinched the hosting rights, Tasmania, and now it's just a matter of who is Tassie going to play in the final, which is coming up on Saturday. So the next round of one-day cup fixtures begins tomorrow, the 21st, and the final round. So Queensland will play South Australia at the Gabba, Tasmania play New South Wales, and WA play Victoria at the WACA ground. So basically this is a race in three for one spot. So New South Wales, Queensland and WA all alive. The fun of it is, going into these games, they all play a different opponent. So it would be a little bit like the NFL red zone. You'll be keeping up to date with all these various different venues. But for New South Wales, a win against Tassie in Hobart will almost guarantee them a spot in the final, regardless of other results. Queensland must beat South Australia at the Gabba. They need to hope New South Wales lose. Otherwise, they need to win and get the bonus point to try and overtake New South Wales. So Queensland need to win and win by a big margin against South Australia. And then there's WA, who must defeat Victoria, and they're hoping both New South Wales and Queensland lose. So they need quite a few things to go their way if they are to make it through. So New South Wales the favoured way, Queensland next, so WA a little more unlikely.
Very interesting round there. So it'll be like Super Saturday in the Premier League. So we'll just be doing around the grounds and checking in on what else is happening there. Interestingly enough, though, that final, Corb, has been pushed out a couple of weeks. I think there's a clash in Hobart with the two women's internationals. I think there's a game on the Friday night and a game on the Sunday. And the final was scheduled for the Saturday, which they've deemed obviously not an option. So it's been actually, I think they've pushed it back a week and a half. So there's still a couple of weeks until the final there. Well, which was a major issue here in Hobart because they were looking for alternative venues. The old TCA ground was thrown around as a possible option to, I don't think they've played there since the 70s. And the place is falling apart as lovely as it is. But so they've actually made the decision to push that back a couple of weeks.
If only you had like a new stadium or something that you could use.
Oh, man.
I hadn't caught up with that, by the way. I think the website I was reading probably needs to be alerted to that as well. It's catching us all out. But there you go. So it won't be Saturday as was initially planned, which means we got this weird hole then in the domestic calendar as we wait for those Shield games to start on March the 5th. Big win last night for Australia. So I saw this written up as the Sophie Molyneux era has begun with a win last night. So everything's an era in modern sport, and so we are living through the Sophie era nowadays. India winning the toss. They sent the Aussies in. Georgia Vole was the star with 88, striking at 154. There was only 24 runs in the last four overs, and you thought, oh, they put the brakes on towards the back end of the innings. Beth Mooney, by the way, went past Meg Lanning to become Australia's leading run scorer in T20 internationals. They were able to restrict India to 144. Harmanpreet Kaur, who became the most capped player in international cricket with 356, more than any other woman in the history of the game. When she was out, big batting collapse. India lost 6 for 7, and ultimately the Aussies won by 19 runs.
Yeah, well, I didn't catch this because I was at the Blockbuster at Ninja at Belrive Oval, so I didn't catch a lot of this. Shout out to Georgia Vole. It was doom and gloom only 4 days ago, Corb, when we couldn't see the next era of Australian females cricketers coming through after their loss in the first round of matches there, or the first match against India. But shout out to Georgia Vole, who scored 80-odd and led that team to a win and keeps that series well and truly alive, given it's a multi-format series.
Off they go to the third of those T20 internationals, and then obviously Alyssa Healy comes back to have her final run, obviously, in the Australian cricket team before her retirement and last international following the Test match in Perth. Before we're out of here, by the way, all these games, you can find them through the ABC Listen app and follow along the whole way through for that Australian Women's Series and the World Cup, by the way. So if you want cricket on your radio, you can find it there through ABC Listen. A couple of quick hits on the way out. I know you've got an important tea time coming up shortly. Tom Morris on SEN reporting that Cricket Australia is considering staging a BBL game to open the season in India. Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up, thumbs up. Obviously the centre of the cricketing universe in India for a one-off game. Fans here will miss out. That's okay. Let's take it to the world. That's the way the game's heading. So let's expose it to India as much as possible.
Ideally in Chennai was the quote in the piece. Went on to say that the deal, far from complete, still needs approval from various stakeholders, including broadcast and the BCCI, but that would be a huge bang to launch the season. And the other part of Tom's story was around the Christmas Day cricket under consideration, with Melbourne as a possible opportunity in the soon-to-be floodlit Junction Oval, which would be about 10,000 people, intimate environment, fit for broadcast. The Renegades as the potential host. And I saw the Hurricanes have been discussed as an opponent. I don't know if you've heard anything from some of your former teammates, but how do you feel about Christmas Day cricket?
Two thumbs up from me, Corb. I think this is inevitable, and it's something that I've spoken privately around the barbecue on a Friday night with my mates. This is a winner, and I think we've seen it with the basketball. They have Christmas Day games. I know a lot of the players and the workers that have to work that day will be put out, but for the greater good, that will be huge for cricket. It's a day on the calendar. I don't think we even have a Christmas Eve game just at the moment, just to please the players for not having to travel and be there Christmas morning with their families and whatever else. I think this has to happen. So two thumbs up for me, and yeah, it'll take some goodwill of the players and some other people, but yeah, hopefully that can happen.
How would Emma go if you said, hey, by the way, I got to go to Melbourne and play cricket? I'll leave you with the kids.
Well, I think they said we might have to pay them a bit more, or private jets and all that sort of stuff.
Families
so I'm
can
sure,
come.
That's right. I'm sure there'll be a way to make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Hit them straight today. X, appreciate your time as always. Thanks for chatting to us on the ABC Cricket Podcast.
Great work, Corb. Enjoyed it.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.